Stephen Godfrey and gentle listeners, welcome back to Phantom Island presented by Homefield. Before we dive into today's topic, we should note tickets are officially on sale for our first Phantom Island live show. The day this comes out, tickets are on sale for our show in Athens on Friday, November 14th.
It's an experience. I don't know if I would say live. I would just say sort of the Phantom Island experience, kind of the same way of like, do you remember when stage shows were more of an activation?
Sure.
Like, so you could do Disney on Ice or like the Ninja Turtles.
Are we doing Phantom Island on Ice?
I was going to
go. I'm not a strong skater.
I can't. So we could in Athens, Georgia, find a sheet of ice. But this is more, I think it's going to be more like a rock opera. I've been working on some music.
Okay, great. Very excited about
what I want to do on every ticket ad read on our show is misrepresent the event.
Sure. I think that's what
that's gonna,
marketing that, definitely.
That's going to move some units.
It's part of the Can't Miss Kickoff Tour presented by Modelo. Homefield's partnering with us on that. And the link to tickets, to purchase tickets, that is, it will be in the show notes. If you're going to be in Athens for the Texas Georgia game, hey, come on out. Come say hi.
You better.
You know, it would be nice. Okay. He's bad cop. I'm good cop.
You have to. It is going to be fun. It is going to be the Friday night before. There are things that are going to happen that we can't announce yet.
Correct.
Some friends and stuff.
Yep.
Some peoples.
Yep.
Some people, maybe you guess. Some people, maybe you wouldn't. There is actually going to be an actual brand activation there other than our friends from Homefield.
Yeah.
There's going to be, it's going to be unique. And if you've been to a live show that Ryan and I have been involved with on in other enterprises, it'll be different.
Yeah.
That's my nice way of saying, like, give us a shot.
All right, let's do the music and then we'll do the show.
Every rustle in the trees, a potential snare. Close my eyes and block my ears. Cut the cord and leave me here.
Okay, so Stephen, an interesting thing happened this year in college football involving Syracuse and Clemson.
They both beat North Carolina.
I don't know if Syracuse has played North
Carolina. I'm future-proofing the show.
I don't even know if they're on the schedule. No, Syracuse beat Clemson.
Yes, they did.
Which is itself somewhat unusual. That's only the third time they've done it in a somewhat limited history against Tigers.
Long time. Yeah, long time ACC rivals.
But more interestingly, a little bit after that victory, Syracuse got fined $25,000 and publicly reprimanded by the ACC. Do you know why?
I think I do. They faked an injury.
They were accused of
allegedly.
They were accused of faking injuries in this win over Clemson. And that's what we're here to talk about today is the history and the, let's say, possible solving of injury faking. We're mostly going to look at it in the NFL, but because of the nature of this conversation and our background, we do have to include college football within this as well.
So, Ryan, what question are we asking today?
We're going to, let's frame it this way. Let's ask, how did the NFL fix its injury faking problem?
I didn't know they had one.
Okay. So I'm going to take you back. We're going to stay in college to begin with. I'm going to take you back to the 1950s. This is where our intern, also named Ryan, found a very early concern about faking injuries in college football. This involves 1953 Notre Dame played a game against Iowa that ended 14-14 because games could still end in a tie.
So Iowa's never legally been allowed to score more than 20 points
in the 50s, I don't think anybody was, in fairness. But at what happened in this game was, at the end of each half, Notre Dame had the ball on offense, and they were having players go down with injuries to keep the clock from running on offense. They were trying to preserve time.
Okay.
This obviously is like a...
It's a different time, yeah.
Yes, and the rules of timeouts and timing were different. But
so this would be like if you were out of timeouts and you were throwing short passes to the sideline, you're trying to advance the ball or call plays in without losing any time on the clock.
Yes, and in this case, it was just, well, if we have to stop the clock because players are getting quote-unquote hurt,
yes,
that will give us time. Notre Dame scored touchdowns at the end of each half, to make this a tie game. And so it was like, okay, this is the thing we have to worry about. But that goes away for some amount of time, and that's where we're going to jump right into the 1980s NFL, specifically the Sam Weish Cincinnati Bengals.
1980s NFL. I can hear the music from NFL films. Sure. AstroTurf, cocaine, shoulder pads.
What do you I'm gonna accidentally throw you on the bus here, under the bus here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember anything about the 1980s Bengals?
I do.
Okay. What do
it's
you
the first Super Bowl that I remember?
What do you remember about their offense?
Boomer Esiason.
Yep.
It was not. I don't think it was a West. It wasn't like the West Coast kind of thing that the Niners were running. And it was who's the running back with glasses? Icky Shuffle. What's the bus throw? Is it what that I don't know the scheme or that I'm old enough to remember? Oh, I don't worry about that. No, yeah. I'm old enough to remember good Bengals.
Yeah. This was also one of the early instances of the modern hurry up offense. Hurry up, no huddle offense.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Continue.
It starts getting popular in the NFL around this time. In the 1988 season playoffs, the Bengals beat the Seahawks in the divisional round, but they thought that Seattle was faking injuries like crazy. They thought basically every time that they tried to speed up, Seattle would have a linebacker or somebody go down. It was so bad that at the end of the game, Sam Weish suggested that the medical code of ethics was being violated by the members of the Seahawks training
like
staff.
Like the Hippocratic Oath?
Yes, like that, that there should be some sort of like licensing investigation into these trainers for attending to obviously fake injuries.
It's an episode of The Pit.
To the best of my knowledge, nobody's license was suspended over this.
By the way, if you're under 35, the Seahawks used to be in the AFC.
Yes, that is another weird thing here. Okay, so.
But I tell you what, my mind's eye right now, all I see are good uniforms.
We're going to jump just a week ahead of that to the AFC Championship that year, where the Cincinnati Bengals are going to play the Marv Levy Buffalo Bills.
Hell yeah.
About, like, I can't pinpoint a time on it, but I think, like, at most a day ahead of this game, the NFL issues this very weird order ahead of the AFC Championship. I'm going to read it to you verbatim.
Is this in Buffalo or Cincinnati? Mind's eye, painting a picture. I'm not trying to disrupt the pot here.
No, it's fine. I'm going to look. It was in Cincinnati.
Okay.
Early January, 1989.
Cincinnati. Yeah, so I was right about the AstroTurf and probably the cocaine.
So, here's the order that the NFL issues ahead of this game. Quote, both clubs have agreed to the following. One, neither team will feign injuries to allow for substitutions or other unfair acts.
Okay.
Two, an offensive play that occurs before the two-minute warning will be nullified and replayed if it is deemed by the officials that the offense gained an unreasonable and unfair advantage by a quick snap of the ball. For example, a quick snap which is intended to cause the defense to be penalized for too many players on the field. This does not prevent a team from running a no-huddle hurry-up offense at any time, provided the violation does not occur. Let's break
do
this
you want
down.
Me to... I'll repeat yeah, that
go
back.
Ahead.
It's
go,
like a learning
yeah,
exercise.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're thinking about this in terms of the modern game, do you know how the ref stands over the ball now?
Yes.
At the college and NFL levels, the ref stands over the ball, basically. So if you swap personnel on offense, the defense can swap personnel accordingly, and you can't snap to either, one, incur this penalty of too many men on the field, or just catch the defense sort of out of alignment or out of coverage in a sort of wildly unfair way.
Yeah.
That's probably the best way of explaining it. But back then in the 80s, again, for some context, personnel did not move on and off the field first, second, third down nearly as often as it does today.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you were in 12, you stayed in 12.
Right.
You know, it was very rare, unless you were in a specific situation, to put in to change your personnel for a formation.
The way I read this is that the NFL was saying, if you run hurry up and you try to snap the ball specifically to catch the defense while they're substituting, whether or not you have substituted.
Yeah.
Because it's not, what you're talking about is if you sub the defense is supposed to be given an opportunity as well. But that doesn't apply if you don't substitute. Yeah. If you're just hurrying up with the same players,
yeah,
you can do that all the way down the field, and the ref will never stand over the ball to give them a chance to
substitute. Is this football's version of like YMCA basketball when you, when you're like inbounding, but you just bounce it off of an unsuspecting defender? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like, I
mean, it was...
I applaud this strategy. I'm shocked hearing this, that the league had to issue a statement. It sounds like the Bengals found a way to exploit something, and it was bugging people before they could change the rules.
So Marv Levy talked about this a little bit, and he, the way, to paraphrase, he sort of is like, this is bad sportsmanship. Like, running a hurry-up specifically to catch a team with its pants down trying to sub is, like, just bad. It's
bad sportsmanship.
Yeah.
God, time's a flat circle. You remember, obviously, when we worked at SB Nation, mm-hmm. I covered all of the Nick Saban / Brett Bielema PR campaign.
Yes, is this what we want football to be?
Is this what we want football to be? And how dangerous it was to run the HUNH, the hurry up, no huddle, which was mainly coming out of Gus Malzahn's Auburn team, but a couple other schools at the time, Texas A&M.
Yes.
Love it.
And the reason they sort of had to issue these two agreements, this pact, this non-aggression pact before the AFC Championship, was... the Bills were sort of implying, I'm not going to say that they were outright threatening, but they were like, look, if Cincinnati is going to do this and we think it's bullshit, we will fake injuries. We don't think faking injuries is like a cool thing to do, but if you're going to play bullshit chess, we're going to play bullshit chess right back with
you. So their only counter tactic was, we'll fake injuries to slow everything.
To slow it down and allow us to substitute. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So... the Bengals won that AFC Championship anyway, as you know.
Went to the Super Bowl, yeah.
And this, and years later, a few years later, because this is also a recurring theme of this story, Marv Levy accused Browns coach Bill Belichick, he's in the news lately, I don't know if you know that.
Nope.
Of faking injuries against his offense. Like, this is what, and this has happened with Brett Bielema too at Arkansas. Oh, like, all of the coaches who are accused of doing this or get mad about it, also are on the other side of it. Like, there is no real honor here. Like, it's very hard to find a coach or a team where you're like, they are only the victims of this and they never exploit it. Never.
Yeah, no, can't say I'm shocked. I mean, yeah, it's an imitator sport, right? Everything inspires a copycat.
There is one coach, we're going to jump all the way to 2010 now. There is one coach in college football history that we could find who has been suspended for a game for participating in fake injury shenanigans. It's not a head coach. It's not a coordinator. It's a position coach.
Really?
Tosh LePoy, a name you will recognize as well, who was at the time.
Tosh LePoy in trouble. What a shock.
The defensive line coach at Cal. Okay. Got suspended for a game because he admitted that he had called for a fake injury against Oregon. This is when they're playing.
Oh, he called the signal in.
Yes.
Okay, so we should pause. Every athlete I know.
Yep.
Sorry, every football player I know, not athlete, has copped to, after their playing days are over, saying, oh, we totally had a signal for
that. Yes, right.
Especially on the line.
Yep.
And then it would be one guy's... like designation, usually the worst offensive lineman, the worst defensive lineman, to be like, oh,
as my hamstring
sniper, you know, we always joke sniper on the TV broadcast. Yes. Like, suddenly you're standing there and the guy goes down.
Yeah. Okay. We later in this episode, I talked to Marshall Newhouse, former offensive lineman in college and the NFL. We talked about some of this as well, but, Tosh, basically the Pac-12 is aware that teams are specifically against Oregon and that like super fast offense that they were running in the mid-2000s and into 2010s, that teams seem to be going down with injuries in ways that felt like they were trying to slow them down. And for whatever reason, Jeff Tedford said, like, yep, our D-line coach copped to it, so he's going to miss. I think he missed the Washington game that year.
Weirdly honest?
Yeah.
Weirdly forthcoming.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I'm not sure if there was any real reward to this, but nothing else happened after that. I will add, because he's going to come back in the story as well.
Nothing else ever happened to Tosh LaPoy.
Do you know one of the defensive linemen on that 2010 Cal team?
Oh gosh, no, not off the top of my head.
Cam Jordan. We're going to come back to Cam Jordan. There's layers to all of this. Okay.
Dun, dun, dun.
2011, we're going to go back to the NFL. Deion Grant and another New York Giant go down with a injury, and I'm making the air quotes again, against the Sam Bradford Rams on Monday Night Football.
Excuse me, sir. Those are the Jeff Fisher Rams.
I apologize. They go down against the Rams on Monday Night Football, and I think the Monday Night Football part of this is important.
Sure.
They do it in such a way that it's the same. It's the thing we're all used to seeing, where defense is standing around figuring out what they're doing next. Somebody sees something on the sideline. They crumple to the ground.
Okay.
This, for some reason, sets the NFL off, because 2 days later, the NFL sends a memo around to every team and lets it be known that a memo has gone around to every team, threatening fines, suspensions, and potential loss of draft picks for teams that do this. When this happens, the thing you were describing about players saying, like, yeah, we had a signal, we had, like, a system for doing this, it starts happening in real time. Players start getting very honest. Scott Fujita, who is part of, like, on one of the committees of the NFLPA at the time and is an active player, says the following in response to the NFL's memo. Quote, I've been places where it has been taught. They have a name for it, and I've been places where it's been pre-called. I've been places where it's one player who has been designated.
Ryan, who did Scott Fujita play for?
At the time, he was not playing for.
No. He spoke in the past tense.
The New Orleans Saints are among the four franchises that he had played for.
This was also
at that point in his career.
No, it was the next year that I tricked Scott Fujita into a Bofa D's Nuts on Twitter, which is maybe the greatest thing I've ever done on social media, including getting my job at SB Nation. Sorry, continue. I like Scott. He was a good sport about it. Injury faking, head hunting.
But, like, Ed Reed, Ed Reed, who, like, is, I don't know, widely regarded as
probably
the greatest
safety
to ever play.
To play football.
Ed Reed is like, this is normal. This is a normal course of business that we do. Frank Gore, who doesn't even play defense, is, like, pretty much the same. He's like, yep, this is a thing that happens. It's just a normal part of the gamesmanship of football.
Sure.
But the NFL.
What's the problem?
Okay, so here's where we're going to get into theory a little bit. I think the NFL didn't like that this happened on Monday Night Football, their, like, shiniest stage of all.
Okay.
I think they don't, and I think they specifically
don't. So if this was, like, buried in a 1 o'clock Houston, Tennessee game.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And
I
think they specifically didn't like it because broadcasters were calling it out.
Deion Grant's been in the league for a while. Miraculously, he recovered quickly. Let's watch him. 34. Oh, wait, we had two guys go down. And fake injuries.
Yeah, I hate to say that he's not really hurt, but that's a tactic that defenses have used in the past against no-huddle offenses.
I think it's Tirico and John Gruden, if I remember rightly, on this broadcast.
That was a salty box.
And I think there's a difference between it's happening, but the public isn't generally aware of it and is not talking about it as much.
Yeah.
And now it is. The other thing that's happening here, as you've sort of alluded to, this is when social media is, like, starting to come into being.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the league is aware, like, when this happens, people can cut out clips of it and it can circulate. Like, it's one thing to say, hey, I was at this game or I was watching this
and I think this happened,
but I'm just telling you off recollection. Yes. It's another thing to say, here is the slow-mo clip. Because that's the other thing the Monday Night Broadcast does. It's like, okay. Let's watch what happens here.
Yes.
Let's break it down.
Yes. Pre-social media or pre-social video.
Yes.
The discretion to highlight something, to go back and to repeat it or clip it out, it's really just SportsCenter or the local news, which doesn't have the sort of, like, permanence or ubiquity that the internet does.
Correct.
So you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe the NFL realizes that they can't brush this inconvenience aside.
So then in 2012... Emmanuel Sanders, who's playing for the Pittsburgh Steelers at the time, gets fined $15,000, and the Steelers get fined $35,000. Now, you might be thinking, Manuel Sanders, to the best of my recollection, that's not a defender. He was a wide receiver.
He's a wide receiver.
Right.
I was thinking that, yes.
This is on Sunday Night Football, which is, again, why I think
which is an even bigger audience, because it's network television.
Yes.
Yeah.
They are playing a game where towards, I think, they're playing a close game where they're trying to conserve timeouts. Ben Roethlisberger takes a sack, gets a little bit shaken, and doesn't want to come out of the game, but they also don't want to burn a timeout. So Ben Roethlisberger basically tells Emmanuel
Points
Sanders,
at, yeah, yes, you're going down.
Go down, yes.
Emmy?
Yes.
Emmanuel?
This is one where Emmanuel Sanders sort of tried to say, like, no, this is real. The problem was, like, two plays later, the Steelers punted. Emmanuel Sanders was on
was
the,
he a gunner?
Was on the punt team and was the first player down
Flying
the field.
Down the field
yeah, was the first player down the field to the ball. So the NFL was like,
miraculous.
I'm going to go ahead and say your hamstring was probably rough shape.
You know what? Could have been a cramp.
So it took 2 weeks, though, for the NFL to issue that fine. Like, it's not the kind of thing where you see it and part of what I think makes this complicated is it's a thing that even people who don't like it, it's not a thing you can deal with in real time. You almost always have to deal with it after the fact for a variety of reasons that we're going to get into.
So you're saying you can't throw a flag on
Yes,
Emmanuel
yes.
Sanders.
So the biggest sort
yeah,
of...
Yeah, that's a slippery slope.
The biggest challenge of this, and referees have talked about this, is referees don't want to be in the position of having to judge medical legitimacy on the field. They're not trained how to do that.
So they don't want to be like every dad in the 1980s telling you to rub some dirt on it.
Yes, you're fine.
You're fine.
Stop crying.
Yeah, that's right.
They don't want to be put
I'll
in that position.
I'll give you something to cry about, Ryan.
Especially because if you're wrong, you look like a complete asshole.
Well, yeah. Liability, too,
yes,
I would assume.
Yes.
I'm sure the Players Association would have a field day with that.
Yeah, so the refs don't want any part of this. All right. I'm going to jump back to college very briefly here.
Okay.
It's 2013. We're still in the same time period. Because this is happening in the NFL, Kirk Herbstreit starts talking about it in college. And this is around the time where what you're talking about with Auburn and other places, like Baylor is running a lot of hurry up. No,
football is moving faster.
Football is
moving. Plays are simplified, blah, blah, blah. It's basically, I don't know how long you want me to wax on this, but like, so Alabama was the best team in football, and they had a very heavy, as in like body size, defense. It was very good, but it was reliant on swapping personnel for specific situations, especially in the secondary, and a lot of offenses came along with really crazy oversimplified systems that could keep the same personnel, call plays incredibly quickly, and keep defenses sort of reeling.
Yes.
This was turned into like fucking McCarthyism.
A crisis.
Just ridiculous.
Yes.
And I was a national reporter at the time. And so when I was doing my rounds through the summer media events, the self-seriousness with which some of these coaches
treated this,
browbeat
yes.
people for even encouraging this.
Yeah.
Like, that the Baylor split wide offense or the zone, basically just the zone read at Auburn was some sort of, like, it wasn't even a crime or an affront to decency the way you were describing it earlier. It was, this is a player safety issue.
Yes.
Someone's going to die out there because Auburn snaps
because
the ball
Auburn
quickly.
Auburn ran 10 more plays.
Yeah.
So Kirk Herbstreit says, we're going to see this more in college. And he claims, quote,
of course,
I've talked to defensive coaches. These guys are actually practicing faking injuries in practice. I don't know if that's true.
I would, you know what, as someone who's spent a career in anonymous quote coach quotes at the collegiate level, I bet that is totally true that someone said, hey, you know what, this is how we're going to combat what's going on. Yeah, that tracks.
Okay. So things just sort of percolate there for about a decade on this subject. And before we get back to what happens, we're going to do a quick read from our friends at Homefield. The focus of this episode is on injuries that sometimes, at least, are not real. But I want to acknowledge that, yeah, we all get hurt and we get sick and we need to recover and recuperate sometimes. Cold and flu season is already upon us, and this is me telling you to take good care of yourself. If you do find yourself feeling under the weather, drink lots of fluids, try to take it easy, and that includes staying home when you can. And what are you going to wear when you do? That's right, home field apparel. I mean, sure, home field's got plenty of stylish, awesome-looking clothing that's made to wear out into the world, but if you're going to be home resting, shouldn't you do it in extremely comfortable joggers and hoodies? Shouldn't you be building a home field-supplied chrysalis around your body while it gets better? You can't fight sickness in jeans. It's just not possible. And look, I'm not a doctor. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not trying to sell you on quackery. I'm not going to point out the millions of people that died during the Black Plague all had one thing in common. They didn't own a stitch of clothing from home field. I'm just going to say that you don't want to find yourself under the weather and not have a comfortable fleece featuring your school's greatest designs on it. That sounds way better than those creepy bird masks from back then. Okay, back to the episode. So for whatever reason, in the NFL, this doesn't really come up again until late in 2022. In college, it continues to be a thing.
We jump for a while.
Every time there's a team that plays with any kind of pace and any injury happens against them, their fans are booing and complaining and insisting like this is fake, whatever. In the NFL, though, in 2022, Jesse Bates, who is a Bengals safety, it always comes back to the Bengals. The Bengals are the most important team in pro football, I think, is what we've learned here. He goes down in a game where Cincy is late getting subs on when Kansas City is close to the end zone, close to scoring a touchdown.
Okay.
It's the same thing.
I remember this game.
This is an afternoon game. It's not, so it kind of, but it's still in the era where, like, if you do this, it's going to get circulated everywhere. It's again, like, you can see him seeing the subs coming on. They're far from midfield, so the subs have like a little bit of a way to go. He can tell they're not going to make it over in time. He goes down, so he gets fined $50,000.
Damn.
Yeah. That same week, Saints defensive end Cam Jordan,
cheater,
who I told you would come back,
cheater,
he also gets fined $50,000. And this is where the NFL is also stacking team fines on top of it. The Saints get fined $350,000, and head coach Dennis Allen and one of the co-defensive coordinators, they get fines on top of that. As a Falcons fan, I'm sure you're like, finally, justice for... Well, I have bad news for you.
Yeah, it would have been more satisfying in an era other than the Dennis Allen run, but yes, continue.
Here's the bad news.
Yeah.
All of the fines against the Saints and Cam Jordan... they all get rescinded because
I remember this.
Turns out Cam Jordan was actually hurt.
Yeah. If anything, they made it worse because they empowered Cam Jordan. Probably my least favorite current Saint.
Like, he appeals. He gives them, like, he's like, here's the MRI.
Yeah.
Here's
yeah.
the diagnosis
I do remember this. Yeah.
I had a sprained foot.
Yeah.
Like, I was actually hurt. I couldn't practice for a while. And this is where also the reporting around this gets really interesting, because it's revealed that the NFL has fined 5 teams for faking injuries that season, in the 2022 season. I have only named 2 teams. Who are the other 3? Which players were they? What happened? We don't know.
Okay.
Like, that's what's so bizarre about the NFL side of this is that, look, if the ACC decides, okay, Syracuse has faked injuries again. Tennessee fans super thought Syracuse was faking injuries in their game against them. But if the ACC says second offense.
You're talking about this year, 2025.
Yes.
If
they say, okay, here's the next fine. Because of the way college football is set up, none of this can happen behind closed doors. It will always have to be publicly announced. Mm-hmm. The amount of the fine will have to be discussed. Like, it will be public fodder. The NFL doesn't work that way. The NFL can sort of have this system by which they say, hey, we're going to penalize you for faking injuries. And sometimes you'll hear about it and sometimes you won't.
Yeah.
Demonstrated by the fact that you have 3 teams that supposedly got fined for doing this and nobody seems to know who they are or what happened with them. In 2023, the then president of the NFLPA, J.C. Treader, said that a player had been fined $50,000 for faking an injury that ended up being a concussion.
Oh!
That's, like, probably the worst in the current landscape of football discussion.
Yeah.
And that's one that's
imbued. No one's made a damning film called Foot Sprain.
Sure. And it's also one that that football has built so much infrastructure into. Like, there is a spotter. There is a designated protocol for how this happens. Like, the idea that one, you could or would fake a concussion is much trickier than I'm grabbing the back of my hamstring I can't get up.
In the time periods that you... Well, in the space between when you jump time in this discussion, concussions become maybe the most threatening topic to the NFL in 30 or 40 years.
Sure, yeah.
It reaches a level of discussion and awareness in youth football enrollment goes down. Mm-hmm. It's discussed at every level, at every media event. It's like... Yeah, it's probably the worst PR going against not only the sport of football, but the NFL.
Yes.
So to misconstrue a concussion for a faked injury is as bad as it could get. And I imagine, and you're about to answer me, this could create a chilling effect in accusing players of faking injuries.
Well, I mean, what Treader pointed out, and I should note, if you haven't listened to it already, the Pablo Torre Finds Out episode's about J.C. Treader and his time at the NFLPA and everything that went on. Like, just go listen to
totally
them.
Normal.
It's a totally bizarre turn of events there. But Treader's whole point is that why would we want to discourage players from coming out of the game because they're exhibiting possible concussion symptoms because they might get fined for coming out of the game? Like, it creates this imbalance of incentives. If we're trying to be very serious about head injuries and brain trauma, why would you put the possibility of, like, oh, but if we think you're faking it, we're going to threaten you with a $50,000 fine on the table?
Okay.
It's just a total mess because part of the challenge here is that, like, you... Like I said, the same dilemma that faces that referees would have to face, which is why I don't think we'll ever live in a world where referees are the ones actually sort of litigating this on the field, is something that leagues have to deal with.
Yes.
Like, part of this is also, and we're going to get into it with Marshall in a little bit here, there is also a signal for go down that means not fake an injury. It means, hey, don't be a hero. Hey, it will be easier and better for everybody if we get a chance to examine you on the field rather than you trying to limp off as fast as you can.
Right.
Like, there is a reason the injury timeout exists.
Yes.
So it exists in this weird sort of like middle ground area. It's also tricky because as we've sort of talked about through the history here, I didn't really think about this going into this episode. It's not just for one thing. Like, we think of faking injuries as you do it to slow a defense down.
You're manipulating. Yeah. Yes. That's the only time I could think of that I would apply faking an injury.
Yes. But
you're telling me there's more.
But, well, we talked about, like, the Steelers use it on offense because they didn't want to burn a timeout.
Okay.
Defenses use it not necessarily to slow a team down, but because, like, subs are late getting on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a, like, well, we got to buy some time here. It's not always that OG Sam Weish Bengals thing of, like, you're going too fast and we're getting tired and we're getting mixed up.
But if where you've brought me in this conversation is this sensitive, kind of hard to qualify gray area of sensitivity to concussions, to injuries, legally required deference to the Players Association, right?
Sure.
These are professionals who are unionized.
Yeah.
And then also maybe an equal or close to it anxiety about manipulation of the game.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you can't rectify this problem without really creating a... If you lean too much in one direction...
You come up with a bad outcome either way.
Especially in, like, the PR sense.
Yes.
And yet, faking injuries is not really prevalent in the NFL, so... How
did this happen?
Why hasn't the friction caused or allowed for more people to manipulate this gray area?
So I'm like, that's a little bit of what I'm about to get into with Marshall on the back half of this episode. So I'm going to leave some of it for that conversation. When we come back, though, I have a few conclusions and one more story I want to tell you.
Okay.
Our guest on this episode of Phantom Island is Marshall Newhouse, long NFL career, successful college career as well. You can listen to him on the Just Win podcast with Ted Wynn, the TCU radio broadcast on the Varsity app. And he's also just go follow Marshall on social media. Like, he's a fun follow because you have an honesty to you about what's going on in football that is very fun and is not hot takey, I would say, but is like, okay, Marshall's really going to tell you what he thinks about what's going on in football. Marshall, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I appreciate the intro. Yeah, I think I was just raised on the internet. I'm a younger millennial, and I like pointing out and observing the absurdity that is sports, but also and I've been playing, you know, multiple sports growing up, and I just think people take it too seriously. So I do like to point out what I see, and then also like to then cut through the seriousness with jokes and
uh-huh.
So, I enjoy following people who do the same.
So we're here today to talk about the phenomenon in both college and pro football of faking injuries, and specifically faking injuries to, I'm going to say, falling into two categories: to slow down a hurry up offense, or, and this is kind of an adjacent category, but it's a little different, to get your get new personnel in. Like, you're not necessarily worried like they're going too fast and we're winded, but it's like, we really want an extra defensive back on the field, but we can't sub. And so we got to sort of like stop the game so we can keep things moving here without burning a timeout. So I want to start from your perspective as a player, both in college and in the NFL. Do players talk about sort of like the fake injury thing? And do they talk about sort of like when this happens on the field, before a game, after a game? Like, what are the conversations about it like between players? Because I know sort of what the fan conversation looks like, but I'm curious like what it looks like in a locker room.
Yeah, I can't recall ever like explicitly talking about this, just because, especially when you're in the pro level, you're so worried about actually staying healthy and keeping a job.
I think you
feel like you're tempting fate, this idea of like ever even considering the idea that you would fake an injury or someone would fake an injury feels like something that like you'd be bringing the wrath upon you. But, you know, it is known that there's a level where, you know, more specifically in college, but in the pros, like, were there to be needed at some kind of stoppage, as you're alluding to, someone somewhere is like, you got to go down. Like, so many things, times I've heard, hey, you got to go down. You got to go down. Or not me specifically, but somewhere, someone on the field needs to just, you know, take a knee, because that stops play. That brings the scurries, the training staff come out and attend to you. And those guys are usually good sports, you know, especially if it doesn't look too super serious. They're just, you hear them just like, hey, everything good? And they're getting you some water and testing out, you know, is it a cramp, whatever, this, that. But yeah, guys never explicitly talked about it. I don't think that players are that clever. I mean, we was, when someone else would do it, we'd be like, what the, you know, what the? But, you know, I don't think we were ever like in a concerted way, you know, wanting and knowing that this is a tactical advantage. And so it's very interesting to see now on the back end, you know, on the college level, obviously slowing down hurry up offenses. Up until this year, you know, it was like a 4-year gap where you could abuse the substitution rule, where with the offense substitutes, the defense gets a chance to match personnel. And so, you know, kind of as gamesmanship, you see defense slow the substitute, necessarily injuries, but you just see gamesmanship a little bit on both levels in different kind of varieties.
When you're on the field, when you're on offense, and you're moving with pace, you're trying to move the ball quickly, does the offense have a sense of like, oh, okay, that guy went down because somebody told him to get down and sort of like slow things down, because part of the gray area here too is like you mentioned cramping, and like a lot of this sort of feels like it falls into the conditioning category in some extent. But also, looking back through this, there is some element of like, sometimes trainers want you to go down because they don't want you to be a hero. Like, they don't want you to just stay out there and sort of like tough it out. It's like, no, you're an important part of our team. We're paying you a lot of money in the NFL and now in college football. We want to like get a look at you and make sure you're okay. But like, does the offense, do you ever recall moments where you're like, yeah, that's what happened there. And we all know that that's what's going on there.
Yeah, definitely. Like I recall 2012, I was with Green Bay, I was starting left tackle, and our offense was largely no huddle, which is rare for the NFL. But, you know, we had had a system with Mike McCarthy and Aaron Rodgers where, you know, we stayed in one or two personnel groupings, and we would really try to up-tempo people. It convinces the offense, so there are less calls, but we could call most of what we wanted from the line of scrimmage, had a lot of code words, and you would start to see as drives get long, there's certain guys you're like, yeah, you know, he's struggling. So we would pinpoint him with running at him, or knowing that we could, you know, if it's a pass play, you could jump set him and just take him out of the play completely. But then you see guys, you're like, oh, you know, he's got big back syndrome and he needs some air. And so, you know, teams would be trying to, this is the universal sign for, hey, on defense specifically, I need a rep. I need a breather.
Yeah.
So yeah, we understood that. And, you know, Aaron Rodgers, kind of adjacent, is one of the best ever at recognizing either guys that are tired or the end of the actual transition of substituting, and he would get guys off sides. And so there was so much that we understood about the mechanics of it all that we could use to our advantage. And it was normally pass rushers, interior D linemen, bigger guys. And then sometimes if we caught them with an extra linebacker, and we were in 11 personnel, which is one tight end, one running back, three wide receivers, then we would kind of press the issue and they would have to adjust to us. And then it's funny also that we, you know, you notice in college I'll just say, for me, the times when I wasn't starting and there's a guy in front of me, it was known like, hey, if you're hurt and it's not catastrophic, like, don't sprint off the field in pride, because all you're doing, like, is it, who does this podcast go to? Like, is this an adult podcast?
You're fucking
the guy that is coming in for you. And I was that guy sometimes where I'd be like, I'm a lineman who I substitute for, you know, on game day, you can only dress so many linemen in the NFL. Right. So I know I'm going in for either tackle, sometimes either guard. Mm-hmm. And so if a guy in front of me goes down, I'm like, go down, even if it's like a rolled ankle and you could tough it out and get off the field, like, go down, take the time, because I'm coming off the bench cold. I'm literally, mm-hmm. quite literally sometimes in Green Bay or cold weather
teams,
cold as shit. Like, you've got to give me time to warm up, or if it's a center, you've got to give the new center time to get some time with the ball, with the quarterback. And, you know, if it's a legit injury, but it's not catastrophic, a lot of guys, that's not going through their head of like, you have got to allow like a moment for people to kind of collect their wits and us to get together. But you're trying to do the three-legged hobble off the field. I'm like, no, that actually doesn't help us right now. So it's very interesting, just like all these use cases for what you're talking about. I'll even talk about another one. Like, literally, I was in the booth last week, TCU at Arizona State, and I was commenting on this to my play-by-play guy. TCU is driving down the field. I think they have like a little over a minute left. They're out of timeouts. Like, I think a tight end catches the ball over the middle, kind of gets banged up, and he's laying down, getting up slow. I'm like, oh, you got to get your butt up. Mm-hmm. You're out of timeouts. There's nothing, like, if people don't know, if a player gets hurt and you're in a two-minute drill and you're out of timeout, or if you have a timeout, they will take a timeout.
They'll burn it for you. Yep.
They'll burn it for you. But if you don't have one left, they're just going to run the clock. And if you're sitting there, they can attend to you, but like your team will literally lose. And it sounds cruel, but it is cruel. It's just like, well, you've got to get up and peel the pancake off the griddle and get off the field or get to the next play. But it's so funny because then, you know, in the play of a normal course of the game, we would want you to kind of just, hey, take a beat, take a second. Whoever's replacing you now has time to kind of get right and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. When you are running hurry up and you see a defender go down and it feels like, okay, maybe this is happening to sort of like slow the pace here. What is the etiquette about sort of calling that out on the field or sort of like raising the attention of that? Like, is that okay to do? Or is there sort of like, you know, you sort of alluded at the top about like, listen, nobody wants to get hurt. So is there some sense about like, yeah, you can grumble about it, but we're not really going to point fingers here.
Like I'll speak for myself. I would never either internally in my head or outwardly, you know, groan or be like, yeah, mm-hmm. unless it was like, unless he grabbed for his hamstring, like that's like the universal, like most, like could very well be faking it. You know, it's like, oh, my hamstring or I'm cramping or whatever. All the other injuries, you're like, it's probably legit. You know, yeah. The NFL has 100% injury rate. Like you see injuries all the time. It's just throughout the course it happens. But if a guy, especially a fat guy, he's sweating, he's breathing heavy, we know we've been going fast, and he grabs his, and like, it doesn't happen right after the play is over. It's like, we're going fast, transitioning to the next play, and he maybe doesn't look to the sideline, but it's just all of a sudden like, ah, my hamstring, like, okay, like what, you know, come on. And so, you know, they'd stop play, and the trainers would come out and they'd stretch him and they'd give him some water, and whether it was legit or not, that, you know, that was the one where you're like, did he?
Part of why I wanted to talk to you is that you came into the league in 2010. 2011 is when the NFL sends this memo around to every team that's like, hey, we're not doing, like, we're going to start fining teams. We reserve the right to take draft picks away. Like, they decide at least publicly to come out and say, this is a thing that we care about. And we really want teams to not encourage this. We don't want players faking injuries. I think largely because it had started to become more obvious on broadcasts and fans were able to sort of call it out and broadcasters were able to call it out. Do you have any memory of like this memo comes out and anything changes or there's any sort of like tenor or vibe that shifts in any way after the NFL sort of like makes it public, like we care about faking injuries and we don't want to see it anymore?
Honestly, no, just because for a memo to come out at that time, we had just gone through a new CBA negotiation and lockout. So like, anything from the league office, we're just like, all right, whatever. You know, they could have told us they were taking all our food out of the cafeteria. We wouldn't have noticed in a memo, you know, until it happened. So yeah, the NFL sending a memo, we're like, you know, what? Okay, fine. And but I can't recall like a watershed moment that was a delineation from the way it was to the way it is now. I don't recall that in my mind, but also I'm old now, so.
No, I get that. How much does it actually bother a hurry-up offense when this happens, when you have, like, an injury fake to stop you guys from rolling? Is it that much of a, like, ah, shit, that really threw us off, or is it just more of, like, a minor annoyance?
It's annoying after, like, like an explosive play. If you're in the middle of a drive and, you know, we, you know, the NFL is a constant chess match between coordinators and QBs and defensive and Mike and guys who, you know, set the defense. If we get you on one and it's a really good play and we're like scrambling, we're going to 20, 30 yards down the field to start the next play and you pull that on us, we're like, what the, you know, that one is real exasperating to deal with. Just because we have the upper hand, like the margin of error in the NFL is so small, we understand there's a moment right here we could take advantage, and you, for whatever reason you're not prepared. For whatever reason, we won the last play, and we're hoping to win the next play, and for someone to kind of go down, and if for it to be the type of the variety where you're questioning the validity of the guy's injury, that is definitely annoying because it just slows, it grinds everything into a halt. It serves its purpose. The defense gets a chance to breathe. They substitute a guy or they, you know, change personnel. And we're all of a sudden our urgency is like slowed down a little bit. Then we can get back going. But especially after those bigger plays, it kind of sucked.
I have a couple different theories about why I think this maybe looks different in the NFL than in college football, and I want to throw them by you. And you can, like, these might all be wrong. I'll just put that out there. So my first theory is that in the NFL, the defense is maybe more hesitant to take certain players off the field even for one play. Like, if you have your best pass rushers on the field, the sort of difference between them being on, all of them being on and not, is different enough between a backup coming on that you're like, it's not really worth it for us. Whereas in college, I think maybe there's a different sort of sense of the roster, and you're like, okay, for one play, we can have our best, you know, our free safety can come off the field for, or something like that. So that's my first theory, is that most of the time in the NFL, you want your best 11 on, and if you, and it's not worth it to slow down an offense if it means you're potentially going to have to lose that player for one play, because the offense is going to identify and say, like, well, that's who, that DB who just came on, we're going to pick on him immediately. That's theory number one. And I'm curious what you think about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's some validity to it. I also just think that defenses are used to platooning. That is kind of the way things are structured. There's an assumption that almost nobody plays every snap. There's like a few guys in the league. If you look at, you know, advanced metrics and snap counts, like, I think Myles Garrett plays most, Max Crosby plays most, most, you know, lockdown corners play most of the snaps. But, like, there's an assumption that, hey, you know, after 4, 5, 6 plays, we rotate guys in. And so, yeah, the offense notices when there might be a stud guy who's leaving. But I don't think, you know, defenses are like, they're not hesitant because that the rest that the guys coming off that will get, the assumption is, hey, in 2-3 plays, he'll have his wind. He'll be back to whatever his level is.
Performances.
So, yeah. But it's just literally all the time they're doing that. So it's just, I don't even know if it's thought of outside of like, oh, this is a crucial third down, we need our best in there or something. They're always shuttling in and out. That's I always resented D lineman for that, because I was like, hey, I got to play every why? I didn't get a chance to sub out. What? Like, so, but I don't know if there's a too big of a concern, unless, yeah, I mean, obviously the drop off in talent is from college to pro can be more significant. But as a general principle, defenses substitute a lot more than offenses do.
Okay. Second theory. I think because of how the sports are structured and practice time and things like this, I think NFL players have better conditioning than college players. And so I think what looks like fake injuries in college is in many cases like, no, these are college guys. And, you know, some of them are coming in and they're still getting used to conditioning at the college level. And so I have this theory of like, maybe we think we're seeing it more in college, but it really is just like, yeah, this is a 19-year-old who's still figuring out what it is to be conditioned at, you know, a power four level. And that sort of makes it seem like it's more prevalent in college, when in reality, it's just like, no, NFL players are just in great condition. And it's less often that you will see them get gassed when you're comparing them to their college counterparts.
I think that's a pretty fair assumption. Like, also, you know, imagine, you know, the level of like overall accountability during the spring, summer, camp, whatever, of a 17-year-old in Oxford, Mississippi, who's going against a up-tempo spread offense. Like, yeah, that makes sense, more so than, you know, you're playing a September game at MetLife Stadium. Like, there's probably not going to be as much of a need for that. Like, yes, there's a different level of conditioning between a college guy and a pro guy. Yeah, obviously. But then there's just an overall level, again, I'll just say, of accountability where you don't expect like a pro showing up out of shape. Mm-hmm. Literally could cost you your job.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. I'm not trusting a 17-year-old who probably had a few beers on Wednesday, who probably is eating like whatever the, you know, well, it's changed now. You know, we didn't have as much nutrition just everywhere.
Yeah, right.
He's probably just eating garbage at the main thing, whatever. until he gets to the, you know, practice facility where they have actual diet and nutrition stuff. So that to me is definitely valid. We would always have guys who were cramp prone in college, but as I got older, I was like, oh, it's always the cramp prone guys are always the same guys. They're always kind of fat, or they're bigger for their position.
Yeah.
I remember not seeing them as much in summer workouts. I remember a lot of tall beers in their hands at, you know, not that none of us had those, but like more so, more often. And so it's just like correlation of just like, okay, there's a level of like, yeah, just lack less responsibility at the college level than the pro level.
And my third theory is that because the relationship, at least historically, between coaches and players is different in the NFL than it is in college. I think if you're a college player and you know, you're a defender and your coach says, go down, basically tells you fake an injury, you know, sniper got you, go fall on your ass. It feels like the power dynamic there is easier than in the NFL. I feel like there is a level of professionalism and pride. I'm imagining two NFL players where if you are a defender in the NFL, like, you don't really want to do this. You know, it looks silly. You know, it's like kind of cheap gamesmanship. And you're playing at the highest level. And I feel like it would be harder to sort of like convince a defender, not impossible, obviously, but harder to sort of tell somebody like I'll give you an example. One of the most recent, a couple years ago, Cam Jordan got fined by the NFL for what they said was faking an injury against Tampa Bay. Didn't end up being faked, like appealed, brought the MRI, whole thing. I think of a guy like Cam Jordan and I'm like, I don't think you could tell Cam Jordan fake an injury to slow. Like, he doesn't strike me as that kind of guy. No. So it feels like the difference in how players approach their job and what like the relationship they have with their coaches would make this harder to do in the NFL in some ways.
Right. No, I think that's totally right. And like, you can visualize, whoever's listening to this, visualize how many times in college you've seen a guy just drop like a fainting goat.
Yep.
Like, whatever code word or a coach on the sidelines, like, you know, gives him an order and he just crashes. And you're like, okay, that's a kid responding to a coach, you know, under a level of coercion, you know, that a pro would be look to the sideline. What? You want me to be what? I think that makes total sense. There's just a different level, obviously more no huddle spread stuff that happens more often. It's just a per capita thing, but also, yeah, just the awareness level of a young kid to be like, to not understand that he's like, he's not being manipulated, but he's being forced to do something that on its face is kind of absurd.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Marshall, thanks so much for taking the time. Everybody follow Marshall on various social media platforms, listen to the Just Win podcast, listen to him on the TCO radio broadcast, and we'll have you back soon.
I appreciate it, man. Pleasure to meet you.
Okay. So first of all, thank you to Marshall for joining me. It was super helpful to talk to somebody who's actually played and actually been in locker rooms and huddles and can sort of talk about like what this is like in person.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you know.
As opposed to us gladiators.
I didn't have a multi-year NFL career, as it turns out.
I did. I just don't talk about it.
You're very humble in that way. So to answer sort of like the overarching question of like, how did the NFL fix its injury problem? Its fake injury problem, I should say. I think the best answer I can muster is they raised the financial penalties on this to such an extent that it makes teams really think twice about it. It's not a thing teams will do casually. Because I think in the old system where it was like coaches are going to complain about it after the fact and maybe like local radio is going to give you a hard time for it, it's like, yeah, but did we win the game? Did we get the stop that we needed to? Who cares? Coaches are always complaining about something. Local radio is always complaining about something. I think once the NFL said, hey, we will fine your organization, like, we will drop a total of $500,000 worth of fines on you and will threaten to do worse if you keep it up.
Well, everything that you mentioned so far, yes, that when you mentioned draft picks in the previous segment, that's where everybody pulls up.
Yep.
That is the, like, I will take your video game system and you won't get to play this semester, young man. Yes. Like, it's hard to enforce anything in college because of the NCAA and the structure. Yep. In the NFL, when you pull draft picks, that always creates the intended result or consequence or change of behavior.
So I think, number one, the NFL successfully created a fear that doing this would lead to consequences, and not necessarily public consequences, because, like we said, you know, the three other teams we don't know about got fined for this at some point in the last
private
few
North
years.
Korean NFL court consequences.
I also think, if we're thinking about, like, well, what's different about the late 80s to now
cocaine,
all the stuff that people love about being a football fan in the modern age, all 22 and this, that, like, now the NFL has, like, okay, we have so much we can track on.
Okay.
What happened when you went to the sideline?
Yeah.
How long were you out? Like, this is the case they sort of tried to make against Cam Jordan. They were like, you know, you came back into the game X plays later or whatever.
Do you do this as an Eagles fan? Do you on Mondays go and find who is mic'd up and then watch the... No, I'm serious.
I don't.
Oh, I love it so much. No. So the Falcons.
Yeah.
Everybody mics up a player.
Sure, yeah.
I think it's an NFL rule for footage and NFL films and everything else. Stuff. Yeah,
yeah, right.
So certain teams, in Atlanta does this, will then create a cut up, probably like 6 minutes.
Yes, I've seen it, yep.
Of like that, highlights, like of that what person. That player was saying and doing and reacting to and all that.
Yeah.
It's an example of, so I've talked to mainly college coaches, but some who have worked in the NFL who are just constantly reminding their players. And this, by the way, holds true now in college. Because of the additional number of cameras, the advancement to HD and then 4K, and now you have sideline cameras that are shooting in 8K.
Yeah.
And the, I already said, like, the increase in the number of total cameras.
Yeah, the coverage.
As well
of the
as the cell phone camera era. Yep. Like, think about how many weird things have happened in college football that was just shot on someone's phone from the third row.
Right.
You can't really hide anything. It's why injury tents became so popular. Yep. The pop-up injury tent was like, just cheered, not because of medical privacy laws.
Not because we all believe in HIPAA all of a sudden.
No, it's just, it's a way to preserve and manipulate the gamesmanship and hide something. So I think your theory is very strong. I think it's the idea of, like, in the 80s, you probably could pull some nonsense.
Yes, and there wasn't anything you could, it was harder to sort of deal with it. But now,
run to some corner of those cavernous multipurpose stadiums that we talked about on a previous episode and do sneaky things, whereas,
So I think that largely explains how the NFL has quote-unquote fixed its injury-faking problem. The fact that they were still fining players a few years ago suggests, like, it hasn't gone away completely. But I will say this. I think if this started out as a optics problem more than a competition problem, I think that's the part they've fixed. That you don't watch a lot of NFL broadcasts where you're like, oh, okay, we're circling this player and laughing about how he's, with 2 seconds left on the play clock, crumbling to the ground. We are, I think, in the early stages of figuring out if college football can solve this problem. Like, is $25,000 and a reprimand going to be enough to, like, I mean, on the one hand, maybe. On the other hand, like, I'm pretty sure Syracuse would absolutely pay $25,000 to beat Clemson on the road. I don't think that's a hard decision.
They'd pay it for pretty much every win in the ACC.
Right.
If they left every win with a reprimand and a $25,000 fine, someone would write that check.
The other problem is that at least now, maybe one day this will be the case, the NCAA can't fine players. Conferences can't fine players. They're not employees. They don't have a salary.
Yeah.
What would you garnish?
That's a good point.
So I think that presents an interesting sort of, will this work in college? There's been a lot thrown out about in college about, like, well, maybe players should have to, you know, one of the popular solutions that was thrown around is if you come out with an injury, you have to sit out the whole drive, and that would dissuade players from faking injuries. The counterpoint to that is that you also don't want players to not admit when they're hurt. That's the flip side of all of this, is that you want hurt players to leave the game.
Yes.
And if you tell them, oh, by the way, it's play two of this drive, you might be out for the next 15 when we need you.
Sure.
It's going to create other problems. Yeah.
No, the first thing that's going to do is that anybody who works in CTE and concussion research is going to tell you that the stigma in the locker room is that you're going to play through something that's probably you should be off the field for it.
Yes. All right. So we're going to end with a story that, since I told it to you, has gone a little bit public, so I can talk about it with a little more specificity. It involves,
Ryan, were you doing reporting?
I wasn't doing any reporting.
Did you do a journalism?
No, I didn't do any journalism.
You did a journalism.
So the University of South Florida Bulls, who beat Florida fair and square, I want to make that very clear in this story, they also played in Miami this year. And Alex Dono of the Locked On Network, who does a podcast about, among other things, does a podcast about Miami Hurricanes, revealed that, like, USF does this thing where after some extra points, they will have a player go down with what appears to be a fake injury. Number one, I am aware of one other team, at least one other team, and I'll say it's a Power 2 team that does this as well.
Yes, I know this team.
I'm not going to say who they are.
Okay.
And what's interesting about this strategy, I'll lay out the strategy as I understand it.
Yes.
When...
To be clear, this is happening now.
Yes.
We are recording this in October of 2025, and this practice is occurring regularly right now by a Power 2 team.
But it exists in this weird gray area. Okay, here's the scenario. Team X, we'll call them. Team X scores quickly on an offensive possession.
Okay.
They
shot play, first down kind of deal, two-play drive, 79 yards, under a minute.
Hit a big pass, whatever.
Gotcha. Okay.
They kick the extra point.
Okay.
But the defense has not gotten much rest because the offense didn't stay on the field that long.
Team X's defense.
Team X's defense, which is about to go back out onto the field.
So let me reframe it then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Team X has a defense go out. Maybe they force a punt. Maybe they were out on the field for 11 plays.
Sure.
Whatever happened.
Yeah.
They get the ball back. The offense comes out, and they're just too dang good and fast.
Yep.
Possession is a scoring possession, a touchdown possession.
A quick scoring possession.
Minute 12.
Yep, great.
Bang.
Great example.
Bang.
Great.
Now, your defense was out at 11 plays.
Yeah.
Your offense just scored quickly. They're still feeling a little gassed.
Yes.
Okay, now so.
Okay, so T-Max's special teams goes out to kick the extra point. Successfully does so. After the extra point, they have a designated player go down with a quote-unquote injury. What this does in practice is it extends the time that between that extra point and the next kickoff. This is usually a place where TV networks are in commercial. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah, it's a dead spot. Yeah.
There is no play clock, obviously. Like, nothing, there is no external, other than, like, I guess the endless march of time itself, there is no external pressure on, hey, we got to do the next thing. There's no, like, potential penalty coming up. The offense isn't trying to do anything. Like, it is a quiet zone of sorts. And what this does is, by adding injury time into it, it extends that. So the defense, which maybe was only going to get, I don't know, 2 minutes of rest between...
Two real live minutes.
Yes. Is maybe now going to get 5 minutes or six.
So they add the injury time on with the TV break.
Yes, it extends. It basically extends the TV break, and we don't go into. Yeah.
So you brought this to me.
Yeah.
And you found this from T-Max.
Yes. Yeah.
It was brought to your attention.
Yeah.
I have confirmed it.
Yeah.
You have shown me. How often is T-Max doing this in the Power 2?
I mean, so it's a situational thing, but I can say that they have done it in previous years, and they're doing it this year, and that it's not the same play. It's not the same player year over year, because the player that they used to have do it is I think graduated. It's not on the team anymore, but it is the same player every time.
I hope
time.
He got NIL.
What's kind of brilliant.
What injury? Where is he? Player A on Team X.
I believe he's a lineman. But he's like a field goal unit line.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Right.
So you're in that sort of, you're in that O-line
crouch position,
right? Not a name
player. Right, yeah.
And he just teeters over?
More or less. I believe that's how it works. Yeah.
Like, he's got a bad case of hiccups?
Yeah.
And just,
you know? Tummy hurts so bad. What's interesting about this is, I don't know, like, if we're talking about gamesmanship, this is like, in the really gray area because you're not stopping the other team from doing something. You're not slowing their offense down. You're not trying to get subs on when you shouldn't be allowed to get subs. You're not preserving a timeout for yourself. You're just giving everybody a little extra rest. So it's like, is it unethical? I guess so, in some strict way, that you shouldn't pretend to be hurt if you're not hurt. But it is like, I appreciate it for this reason.
I like that you're taking it from the stance of a parent where you're like, you need that nap.
It's
fussy, fussy.
It's kind of like the most ethical way you can fake an injury, I guess.
How many have you seen T-Max do it this season?
I haven't seen it happen this season, but I am.
Here's the tricky part.
Yeah.
You would have to see T-Max in person to really confirm
it. That's the other brilliance of it, is that it's not during a normal broadcast period. And because it's not a player that the broadcast is like, oh, people are gonna wanna know that, like, if this happened to the kicker, if the kicker went down, I think they would come back from commercial and be like, hey, just so you know.
Yeah, you this usually happened. Don't have starting a line on those units.
No. Yeah. So it's kind of like, it's kind of the perfect crime. Except we all know about it now. That's the negative.
Everyone who listens to Phantom Island knows about it. We haven't named the school. Is there a reason why you don't want to name it? You brought this. Ryan did a journalism.
Yeah.
It wasn't the bag man guy.
No.
The dirt bag didn't do this. Yeah. This is not my gossip.
I had a source who brought it to me.
Uh-huh.
No, I just, here's why I don't want
to. Welcome to journalism, by the way.
Here's why
I need you to make less money and smoke vociferously.
Here's why I don't want to name the team. Okay. I want listeners of this podcast who are at college football games, I want them to be watching for this. Yeah.
Taking away their pee breaks.
I know USF is the one that's been publicly named as, like, we think they're doing this. I know Team X is the other, but I don't know. I'd be thrilled if people started writing into us and been like, hey.
USF and another team.
If people want to come back to us and be like, this is an epidemic, this is the next thing we have to, is this what we want extra points to be?
Can I scare you a little bit?
Sure.
You probably gave it away by saying it's USF and another team.
Thank you to Marshall for joining us on this episode and to our intern, Ryan Fortune, who contributed research on this subject. Phantom Island is produced by Michael Serber and presented by Homefield. Our theme music by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard comes from the song Phantom Island from their album of the same name. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.